listening to the most original talk radio station anywhere. We are LA Talk Radio at latalkradio.com.
You're listening to State of the Arts with Michael Sterling and Paul Strolley right here on LA Talk Radio.
And wouldn't you know it, it is October 17th.
It is.
Beautiful day in Los Angeles.
It's gorgeous.
And nationally speaking, it is also Bullying Day. I mean, I would assume anti-bullying day.
Unless there's a whole movement
Somehow
I don't know about.
Didn't make it
it's Bullying
right
Day.
Before
so before we go off the
head.
Air, Michael's going to beat the tar
yeah,
out
there
of
there you go. It's no, it's nice. Because I thought of you when I woke up this morning and realized that it was anti-bullying.
Oh, yes. For our guests that we haven't introduced, we should tell them. I just finished a short film called The Beating, which is a film about bullying. So that is what Michael is referring to.
Yes.
He's not referring to my personal history
no,
as either
Lord,
a bully
no.
or a victim,
not
one
at all.
Or the other. We'd like to thank our sponsor, Breakdown Services, the entertainment industry standard used around the world, providing the most professional means to reach talent agents as well as actors when casting a project. To learn more about Breakdown Services, visit BreakdownExpress.com.
We'd also like to acknowledge PerformingArtsLive.com, one of the Internet's most prominent listing sources for the live arts in Southern California. We're grateful to Performing Arts Live for lending their support to our live arts calendar.
Two guests in one, or two guests in studio,
what?
Actually. And we have both on stage and behind the scenes represented today. One is an actor portraying probably the most iconic legend in the history of the biz called show, Walt Disney. And the other an author, an award-winning journalist, and an author who, along with five books to his credit, is also recognized as one of the leading experts on television, media, and the entertainment business. Please welcome actor Tim Martin Gleason and writer Ray Richmond.
Yeah.
Hi, guys.
Wow.
Yeah. Wow.
That in-studio audience is amazing.
Aren't they great?
Yes.
And so disciplined.
Yeah.
Did you
can
notice?
Fit like 30 people in here.
Yeah, we just got like that, and they stopped.
Wow. Well,
oh, you brought them.
They're just happy that it's Anti-Bullying Day. I love the fact that the other 364 days of the year are Bullying Day.
Yeah, exactly.
Thank God for me.
We had to set one aside. So, Michael, before we get started, how was your week?
It was good.
How'd
it was
go?
Busy. It was, working on this lovely show that Tim is starring in.
Mm-hmm.
Have the pleasure of doing that, When You Wish, the story of Walt Disney. So we'll talk about that when we get to Tim. But
I have a question about where it's happening. Where's Froude?
Froude.
Who is it?
His name is Richard Froude.
Richard
not to be
Froude.
Confused with Freud.
Right, because it's spelled, it's written like Freud.
It is, but it's the Richard Froude Playhouse on campus at UCLA.
And then who was Richard Froude? Do you know?
The son of Arthur Froude. I don't know.
Okay.
What are you asking that for?
I don't know, because I always got the broad mixed up, and you cleared that up for me.
Well,
you gave me the whole history.
Because that's a famous family.
So I just assumed that maybe you knew the Froudes from the Freuds. But, sorry.
Yes, it's like you say potato, I say potato, isn't it?
Yeah.
I guess.
So it's going well.
Yes, we're going very, very well, and it's just a busy week in theater in Los Angeles in general. Wait Until Dark, opening at the Geffen here, and all sorts of other things happening around town. So
I love that show.
Yeah,
and it's not
scary,
done on stage
scary
enough.
Show.
I love the film, of course, because it's one of
my gal
Audrey Hepburn. Yeah,
very
beautiful
scary.
Woman in the world. That was one of those movies from the 70s. It was the 70s, I believe, late 60s, possibly.
I don't know.
But I tell you, it's one of those things. Those movies from that time just really got under your skin. It was that one which scared me. There was one called Let's Scare Jessica to Death, much trashier, of course, and a great one with George C. Scott called The Changeling. Very, very scary
I've
movie.
I've heard of that. Yes, that I've heard of. Not seen it.
Really,
The Exorcist is what put me under, so I stopped watching those kinds of films.
Oh, really?
Yeah, I truly did.
Really?
I'm Catholic.
Yeah.
Yeah, so I bought into every bit of it.
Really?
Yeah.
No, see, I'm one of the defrocked Catholics. I'm one of the few Italian Protestants, actually. No, my father converted for my mother. So my father's Italian, but I'm Protestant and was totally at a loss at any family wedding or anything. Didn't know when to stand up or kneel or anything. It was quite embarrassing.
Well,
anyway.
You've made up for it in spades.
Well, let's get to our guests that we have here, Michael. Do you want to start with them and start with Tim and give him the intro he is so due?
Our first guest, ladies and gentlemen, wowed audiences with his performance as the tortured masked phantom in the national touring company of Andrew Lloyd Webber's The Phantom of the Opera. His portrayal of the lethally passionate impresario garnered rave reviews across the country and accolades from legendary director Hal Prince and original composer Andrew Lloyd Webber. He made history by performing the role on Broadway and across the country more than anyone else in history over 2,600 times. He's off on a new journey now, portraying not a phantom but a very real man and probably the most influential and powerful man in the history of entertainment. As we said earlier, playing the title role in When You Wish, the story of Walt Disney, currently enjoying its world premiere at the Froude Playhouse on campus at UCLA. Please welcome Tim Martin Gleason.
Hello, there's, sir. There's that audience again.
Yeah. Well, you brought him.
You said I could, so I did. Hi, Mom. Hi, Dad. So, they're all out there.
So, Tim, let me ask you this. You opened last night, so your butt is pretty probably pretty dragging today. You don't seem it, certainly.
No, it's not, too bad. Yeah, we had a nice opening, a nice little reception afterwards, so there was some libations that were partook in.
Some solace in the grape.
Yes, some solace in the grape.
Walt would have been pleased.
Yes. So Nothing too crazy, we got a show tonight, so, you gotta be professional about it, but we all had a good time, it was nice, yeah.
It was a very nice time, the audience was very, very enthusiastic, and it was a beautiful opening, actually, so.
Yeah. I'm excited to see it, gonna see it on Saturday with my father, and Monica, looking forward to it.
Great.
Well, it's a beautiful, beautiful score, and a beautiful performance by Tim. He's got one of probably, and I say this unbiasedly, not just because you're sitting here, I've told you this before, he's got one of the most glorious voices I've ever heard in the theater.
Wow.
Seriously.
Thank you, man.
Seriously.
Thank you very much.
Very, very
it
nice
is thrilling. It's the kind of voice that comes along every once in a great while.
Wow. You should be my agent.
I tell you. Well, he's just reading what's on that card you're holding.
So, right. You know. Totally. My mom wrote this card. Hi, Mom. She's very proud out there.
So now for... it is obviously an autobiographical piece about Walt Disney. Now, what... I'm curious about this because of, his life. How many ages do you play? Like, where do you start and where do you end in terms of... It ends with the creation of Disneyland. Is that correct?
Yes. Yeah. The show begins with a very quick vignette of Walt as a little boy, which I obviously don't play that part. The stage can only do so much. But then it flash forwards and it starts when I'm about 21, and the bulk of the play is from like 21 to like 30 something. And then we flash forward till about 20 years. And then the last 10, 15 minutes of the play, I'm probably in my early 50s, I think.
Yeah.
But the bulk of it is from the ages of 21 to like 32.
Okay. Now, this is actually a question for both you and Michael, because I don't know a lot about the production. I was just curious. This is sort of a dream project of the author, right?
Dean McClure. Yes.
Dean McClure, right. Yes. Yeah.
And was this something that you were just sort of... was there any sort of workshop aspect to it? Was it just sort of a script? Like, how did you just... was it just straight audition for you? Did he just track you down? Had he seen your work before?
It was straight audition. Went in like everyone else, and I guess he had first workshopped it about 15 years ago.
He's workshopped it throughout the years.
Yeah. Oh, he has. Yeah. Okay, I thought only once, yeah,
it's an 18-year project, though.
Oh, wow.
Yeah, I didn't know. But I think it was on the shelf for a long, long time. Or not necessarily on the shelf, but just not, it wasn't actively being worked on for a period of time there. But it kind of all came together this year, and I went in and auditioned, just the normal process. And, and got the part. And, it being a new show and going up on stage for the first time, there is a whole process of discovery, of learning what it is we're doing. Including Dean, in figuring out what exactly this piece is, and that's a daunting process and that takes time, and it's also an exciting process to be able to be on the ground floor and to have your input heard, because it's nice to know that as it goes on that some of what we've all created as a team kind of stays with the show, and that's
right.
It's a pretty exciting thing. So.
And the other important thing I just want to add to what Tim's saying is that this is the first time ever that a musical has been approached on the
which
life
is
of Walt Disney.
Which is astonishing to me.
And yes,
so influential would not
it's
be.
Really astonishes everyone. This, however, has the blessing of the Disney family, and Diane Disney in particular, who is very protective of her father's image, and also Roy Disney shepherding this project along when he was alive, and condoning that it should move forward. And Dean was very, very loyal and sensitive to their wishes. And I think what is on stage ultimately is a very, very real look at Walt and his brother, because his brother was so influential in in what happened, resisting many times in the process of Walt's dreams and his visions, but ultimately coming around in that tough brotherly love, but ultimately pushing forward to the success of which, of course, we all know.
That's actually a very similar dynamic to Charlie and Sidney Chaplin. It's the same thing. You know, Charlie Chaplin, mm-hmm. of course, being the upfront guy, but Sidney, his brother, sort of being right there as sort of consigliere and so co-responsible for the right. for the success.
Interesting you bring that up, because Charlie was one of Walt's idols.
And he was actually something that was added that I don't think was initially in the piece, but our director and choreographer came up with the idea of having Charlie kind of interspersed throughout the piece, because as Michael said, Charlie was his inspiration. So Charlie, you do see Charlie in and out of the piece every once in a while. In our little show.
What for you in doing the show and building the character? What were some of the biggest surprises or things that you think, without giving too much away for audiences, listening audience that want to see it? Were any big surprises for you for the journey of his life?
Well, I, to be honest, I did not know the Walt Disney story. You know, I grew up. I didn't grow up on the Disney movies, which is very odd because I'm kind of right in that age where I would have seen all those movies, but it's astounding. All these, they touch upon so many of the Disney movies in our piece, and I had never seen any of them.
Really?
Yeah, before this piece. So I made it a point to sit down and watch some. And but the most astounding thing is that it's very inspiring, his story. I mean, he should have failed half a dozen times, maybe a dozen times. He should have packed up and walked away. And he just never did. And
did fail greatly at the start.
He did. Yeah, yeah. I mean, when I say he should have failed, meaning that he should have given up.
Yeah.
Yes.
Oh, okay, yeah.
No, he failed many times, but he should have packed it up and called it a day, and called it a life many a time, and he never did. And it's it's an inspiring story, because it just goes to show that when you believe in something, and if you just don't stop, and if you just keep pushing. If you truly believe in something, it will happen. And that's, essentially what the story of Walt Disney is, which is pretty inspiring.
Well, and there's a very touching time in this show where there's a scene between Walt and his wife, and Walt is at a very, very high level of anxiety, and his wife is telling him, basically, in this kind of heated discussion a little bit, you're a visionary, that you no one thinks like, no one has the mind that you have, and that really brings it home. That's why he's so relentless in wanting to, fulfill these dreams that he has. Well, and it's also shared by his brother. That's one of the problems between the brother and Roy and Walt.
Sure.
Roy can't fully comprehend, why, how, what, because he has no understanding of anything but the art.
And that's the thing, and that's why Rory was so important, is that Walt could not have done this on his own.
Yeah.
And it wasn't just about the money. Walt didn't have the business sense.
I was just going to ask you that. Yeah. Was Roy more the business and sure. Walt
absolutely.
More the creative?
Yeah. Absolutely. I mean, from what I understand from the piece, absolutely. And, Walt, and you'll see in the piece, he's not the easiest guy to get along with always. I mean, and that's what happens when you're a visionary, when like you said, Michael, when you have a brain like no other. You're always two steps ahead,
right.
and everyone else is playing catch up. And his brother Rory had to constantly do that. And I'm sure Rory got used to it and got to know the brain of his brother better than anybody. But Walt was constantly, his brain was just seemed to be turning so much with ideas that Rory was the one to keep him grounded, the one to keep him focused. I think in certain aspects and. Yeah, it was definitely a duo that without the two of them together, none of this would have been accomplished.
No, that also sounds very similar to the Chaplin thing.
Yeah, yeah. And then I think Ad Lillian, his wife,
sure,
you know, who was certainly played an important role in
absolutely
him together. And
yeah, I mean, she was a true believer in his ability and his talent, and when things got down, which they often did, for the Disney, she was the rock, you know, that kind of, you know, kept him afloat.
I'm astounded that you didn't see any of these movies as a kid.
I was astounded. I was like, you know, as they were doing this montage of movies, I was like, nope, not that one. Nope. I mean, my first one was Little Mermaid. That's where it kind of started for
me.
Oh,
really? Wow. Yeah. You know, I don't know. I mean, I think, Ray, you and I are approximately the same age, and I know for me that...
33?
Yeah, exactly. for me, Disney, the biggest connection for Disney with me, and I don't know about you, Michael, but... it wasn't so much the films. It was Wonderful World of Disney on Sunday nights,
and then Wonderful World of Color, and what? Right. It kept evolving. It was always something on Sunday at 7 p.m.
Was exactly. It Wonderful World of Color?
It evolved into that, and it was prior to that, I think. Well, I may be a little older than you. In the 60s, oh, it was Wonderful World of Color, and then Disney. You know that Disneyland actually started with a show on ABC in the 50s.
Oh, okay.
I don't know if they get into that. In the play.
No.
It actually, a show called Disneyland, it was the first infomercial.
Oh, oh
for,
yeah.
For like 2 hours, hosted by Walt.
Oh,
yes.
Oh, that's the one you see all the clips where he's interviewing people in the offices and the Mouseketeers come in.
Exactly.
And they talk. Yeah, okay. Yeah,
it was like this three-year, you know,
right.
Four-play build-up.
Right. No, but I remember just the music playing on Sunday nights. I remember
sure.
hearing
well,
that.
It was very magical.
And it was right before Mutual of Omaha's Wild Kingdom.
That's right.
It was just those two things on Sunday nights. And I remember when Mutual of Omaha's Wild Kingdom came on after Disney, that's when I got sad because that meant I had to go to bed because I had school the next
day.
Right. Painful memory. we're talking about good memories, though. This is the show we're discussing is called When You Wish. It's a world premiere musical about the life of Walt Disney. It is playing at just opened last night at the Froude Playhouse. This is at UCLA. 405 Hilgard Avenue in Los Angeles, and it plays Wednesday, Thursday, and Friday evenings at 8, Saturdays at 2 and 8, and Sundays at 2. Tickets are, and we'll throw this information out again a couple of times before the end of the hour, Ticketmaster.com, or you can call UCLA Central Ticket Office at 310-825-2101. That's 310-825-2101, or Ticketmaster.com. Looking forward to it on Sunday.
Yeah, you're going to have
Saturday,
a
rather.
Fantastic time, I promise yeah. you are. Now, Tim, I want to ask you a question about preceding your involvement here with this wonderful project, but your life on Broadway and on the national tour of Phantom and,
sure.
and all of these records that you are holding with that show. And how did you, first of all, what was that road like getting to into that role? That's no easy
yeah.
feat.
I took the... I took the ass backwards way to get to Broadway. I never took a lesson. I never took an acting class. Never took a voice lesson as a kid. Never did any of that. Went to university to study something completely normal, like business. And I ended up with a psychology degree only because I was not a very good student, and that's what I found the most interesting, and that I would actually get up and go to class for.
Are you psychoanalyzing all of us?
Absolutely.
Right now?
You are all screwed up in the head.
I was wondering why he was taking notes.
Really?
I didn't want to mention anything.
Yeah.
Yeah.
It's just a little thing he does.
So I graduated from college, and I went off into business for 5 years. You know, I grew up Irish Catholic conservative, and it was always kind of the mentality always seemed to be you get a job that affords you your life. You know, that affords you your weekend. And that's just kind of the way it was. And I was in my mid-20s, and I kind of just looked around, and nobody was paying attention to me anymore, if that makes any sense. Like, nobody... I had kind of gotten to this point because I was doing what I thought everyone wanted me to do, and then I looked around and realized nobody was paying attention anymore. And I was like, this sucks. I don't want this. And yes, there it is. Talk about the production value on this show.
I tell, we're high end, aren't we?
Right.
Through the roof.
Yeah, so I did have a weep womp moment in my life. I was working for a rental car company. I was eating a bagel with a lot of butter on it. I was probably about 25 pounds overweight, and I was looking.
You're painting a magical
right,
picture.
Right, I'm telling you. It was as magical gets, and I'm looking through the newspaper, and I saw this ad for auditions for a local theater troupe. And I was like, that's what's missing in my life. I haven't done theater in 3 or 4 years since college, and that's what I need. And it was really more about maybe meeting a nice girl or something. I was kind of lonely and, you know, out of school a couple years. So I was like, that's what will shake things up. I'll go do a play at night, and it'll kind of satisfy me in life. And so I went and I auditioned for this very large theater troupe, and I ended up getting Tony in West Side Story. Which I had never heard of West Side Story, believe it or not. I mean, I had heard of it, but I didn't know the show. Right. I didn't know what Tony was, and so I didn't realize the big pile of dung I stepped into as far as the amount of work that was going to be ahead of me. And that's kind of where it began. And, you know, growing up in Jersey, it's about 45 minutes from Broadway, from Manhattan, and so it was close enough where a lot of people that were involved knew friends of friends, and you know, they just started saying things to me like, you're pretty good, man, you should go. And I was like, really? It never crossed my mind. I never thought I was good enough. And when enough people tell you that, you know, you just kind of start to believe it. And what I started doing was I was like, all right, if this is really true, what I'm going to do is I'm going to go to New York and I'm going to go to these piano bars people are talking about. And I'm going to go sing in a piano bar and someone will discover me that way. And I had this whole plan, and my friend Patty would go into New York on the weekends and sing, and she had a great voice too, and that's what happened. There was an agent there one night. And
really?
Yeah.
Wow.
And they came up
great.
To me and they said, hey, you're pretty good. Who represents you? And I was like, I work out in New Jersey. I work a 9-to-5 job. I'm just here for fun. She's like, oh, well, if you change your mind, here's my card. And I sat on that card for about 3 months, and finally I took the plunge, and you know, the short of it is my sister was living in New York and she said, come in and sleep on my couch for as long as you need to. And I did that for a year, and I started auditioning, and it took me about 2 years to get Phantom, and I got some really nice work before that, some nice regional stuff, a few new projects like When You Wish, and but then Phantom came along, and that was the first, you know, that was the first really big thing that I was a part of. And yeah, so it was a very different way to get there, but I feel blessed by it. I feel like it kind of makes me, you know, I grew up bridge and tunnel people. You know, that's what you call the people in Jersey and Connecticut.
Yeah, the people
that go see theater. So I feel like I can relate to them from the stage more than a lot of people who maybe have been sheltered all their life because of conservatory or because of, I grew up very normal. I grew up, you know, playing baseball in high school and, you know, very, very like the average Joe. So I feel like the average Joe can relate to me, and that's 90% of the people in the audience. So I think it kind of serves me well that was the journey that I took.
But it also seems to me that you grew up with a very, I don't want to say that performers don't have like a good work ethic, but you have a tremendous work ethic. I mean, to do 2,600 performances of that role, you really...
Yeah.
I mean, that's a job. That's sort of really going in and punching the clock and doing your work and doing it with a fervor there. How did you keep that fresh for yourself?
Well, I think what you know, it's funny because it is a bit of a dubious honor in the sense that, you know, as an actor, you don't necessarily want to be doing the same role for 7 years, but it never got unenjoyable for me. So there was no need to leave. And if something had come along that I felt like, all right, it's time to move on, I would have. But nothing did. And, you know, I was a Phantom understudy that whole time before I took over for Phantom full time. So I got to play the Phantom a lot, which kind of mixed it up. I did Raoul with 15 different Christines over the years. That certainly mixes it up. 4 different companies.
Wow.
I did the tour. I did... Broadway. I originated Raoul in the Las Vegas company, and then back to Broadway, and then back out on tour. So all those changes really helped mix it up. But
yeah, keep it fresh.
I think what I'm most proud of with that whole thing is that, you know, your contract is 6 months at a time, so you have to be doing your job if they're gonna keep you on.
Right.
So I'm most proud of that. I feel like I actually did keep it fresh. It wasn't that I just coasted for 2,600 role performances.
Right.
I actually was able to keep it fresh to the point where they kept saying, yeah, you're doing a good job.
Well, you would have had to, or
right.
else you wouldn't
right.
have gotten that.
Right.
Contract.
So,
yeah.
So it was, you know, this may sound very trite, but it was a very nice paycheck. So that's kind of the inspiration for the work ethic.
For an actor, well, that's never trite.
Yeah, so also kind of the platinum card role of theater.
Sure,
right?
Sure. I mean, but it's, as you know, as actors, you know, I think we don't sign on, although I may have signed on. We don't normally sign on because we're like, yes, this is where I'm going to make all my money, which is what's interesting is I kind of did. Yeah. I was in business, and I decided to become an actor because I thought I could make a boatload of money on it. I don't know why I thought that, because everyone's like, you're crazy. What are you doing?
Kind of like Walt Disney.
Right. Yeah. I guess so. I guess so in a little way. But I just had this, I don't know if it was false confidence or whatever. I was like, yeah, I'm going to go in New York and I'm gonna make it. And I'm going to make a lot of money.
I think you have to think like that.
Yeah.
Oh, yeah. Regardless.
Well, it's also self-fulfilling prophecy.
Too. Exactly.
Sure. I'm a believer in that. You envision it happening.
Isn't that, what's that, the letter, the secret letter? What is that, film, that cult film that's out?
Oh.
What is it called?
The Secret?
Yeah, The Secret.
It's
secret.
Like, that's the thing that Oprah was pushing for a long time.
Was she
the
really?
Secret? I thought she was, yeah.
I thought it had to do with weight loss.
Well, I think it has to do with anything. Anything that you put your mind to.
It's an approach, yeah.
Right, yes, it's an approach.
So, I thought I was going to make nothing in journalism. Is that why I
have? Yeah.
One more time.
That was Ray Richard. We're going to talk to you in mere moments, but we want to do our arts calendar first, Michael.
Yeah, but let's just tell them how to see Tim one more time.
Oh, sure.
Last time, in an extraordinary performance, truly, and I say this unbiasedly, in When You Wish, the story of Walt Disney, currently on stage at the Froude Playhouse, UCLA. And you know where that is here in Los Angeles, folks. So get out of your houses. Get away from the televisions and put the remote down. Get in your car and drive over to the Froude and see this man's work in a most beautiful show that has hopes of going to Broadway, and I hope that it does. And it is through the 3rd of November. Tickets are available by calling the UCLA Central Ticket Office at 310-825-2101 and or going to Ticketmaster, ticketmaster.com. And do it fast. Yep. There's only a couple weeks left.
All right.
Yes.
All right.
Yes, sir.
And I already have.
All right.
Michael, do you want to kick off the arts calendar for you? Do you saw a show?
I do. I have a little bit to talk about, so why don't you kick it off?
I will. Kiss Me, Kate has been charming audiences for generations with a clever combination of Shakespeare's Taming of the Shrew and backstage shenanigans during the production of a musical version of the play. Kate, with a book by Sam and Bella Spiewak, is considered to contain Cole Porter's most popular score. It's no wonder that the show, a Tony winner for Best Musical, was later revived on Broadway, winning another for Best Revival. The score leaps nimbly from hit song to hit song, including Too Darn Hot, Another Open, Another Show, I Hate Men, and more. The dances run the full range of musical theater styles, dazzling at every turn. The result is a unique blend that has audiences laughing and cheering from beginning to end, starring Davis Gaines and directed by Richard Israel, both friends of State of the Arts.
We've
had both of them on the show. Kiss Me, Kate, playing very limited run at Cabrillo Music Theater through October 27th.
Sounds like a winner to me.
Yes. Well, Cabrillo always does great stuff.
And you know, speaking of that wonderful star and the director and choreographers and so forth, and
Richard Israel?
Yes, I mean, he's terrific. And When You Wish is directed by two of L.A.'s finest, Larry Rabin directing with Lee Martino choreographing. Can't get any better than that. But I was out at the theater, and I went to the NoHo Art Center, Paul, and
saw
a wonderful play. Actually, I'm going to suggest that you might want to go see this yourself. It's called The Light Bulb, and it was written by a marvelous playwright who's kind of making some noise. And you remember when we had Harry Hamlin on the show?
Yes.
That was the same author that did his production of that.
This is the show that Rob Arbogast is in, a friend of Kimberly Miller.
And actually, a friend of mine, my friend Chad Coe is in it as well.
It's just sensational. Yeah. It is Joshua Ravitch's innate sense of humor and his very wondrous wit just, you know, dig into this amazing concept of this. It's not an amazing concept, but it's a very interesting concept, I should say. Of a group of advertising marketing people who are very, very different personalities. And they are all faced with the problem of advertising a new product, which is a light bulb that is said to never burn out. It has no
planned obsolescence.
Yeah, exactly. And,
right.
it comes from an offbeat kind of inventor, and they jump into it because they kind of seize the opportunity because they see the greater picture. And it exploits advertising and marketing in a way that I think that is not necessarily surprising, but it's in Ravitch's, you know, way with words and his understanding of the humor and these characters.
Of a dark comedy?
It is. It's absurd. It's an absurd comedy, yes. And it's just, I had sat there with a smile on my face from the beginning to the end.
Okay.
And it really takes you on quite a ride. And then it takes a turn toward the end, and it pulls it all back into the reality.
And this is at NoHo Art Center?
Yes.
Okay.
The reality of ourselves and, you know, the identity that we all have in what we, you know, that saying, you are who you'd like to be.
Right.
Or I think I said it wrong. I can't remember. It's from a song. It's a lyric from a song. Anyhow, nevertheless, it takes you to the place that, you know, it focuses on who we think we are when we're not necessarily really that person.
And
as well.
What is the title again?
It's called The Light Bulb.
The Light Bulb.
Okay. Yeah.
Cool. Is it the small venue?
No. It's on Main Stage.
On the Main Stage?
Yeah.
Okay, good.
Yeah, but I highly recommend it. It's playing at NoHo Art Center, as we said, and it is playing through the 9th of November. And that's a beautiful space over there on Magnolia, just east.
Park once, walk to 5 different restaurants.
Yeah.
Always push that in L.A. I always do. Always try to.
Just east of Lancashire Boulevard there, of course. And for tickets, you call 818-508-7101 or visit nohoartscenter.com. But I really... James Mellon, another great director in town, did this, and I love his work, and he really had a nice handle on the direction, beautiful direction.
Cool.
And the show just moves, 90 minutes, no intermission.
Oh, cool.
Yeah.
All right, sounds good. Our next guest has worked as a television critic, feature writer, columnist, and blogger for publications spanning the worlds of print, L.A. Times, Orange County Register, L.A. Daily News, Daily Variety, Hollywood Reporter, and online, the leading industry resource Deadline Hollywood. He is also the author of 5 books on entertainment, including The Simpsons, A Complete Guide to Our Favorite Family, HarperCollins, a New York Times bestseller, chronicling the first 8 seasons of the iconic Fox animated comedy, and Rescue Me Retrospective. That's a final season tribute to compilation to the Emmy Award-winning FX firefighter drama Rescue Me. Fantastic show. In 2009, he launched his own firm, the Ray Richmond Company, where his clients include Deadline Hollywood and Hallmark Entertainment. He currently writes a twice-monthly column featuring below-the-line Hollywood professionals for the Burbank Leader and Glendale News Press. Please welcome, he's back, he's bigger than ever, Ray Richmond.
Oh, holy cow.
How are you?
Wow. Thank you, yeah. Roger Daltrey.
Yeah, you know.
I'm great, thank you.
Yeah,
thanks so
you.
Much for having me here. It's you know, from that bio, it sounds absolutely like I cannot keep a job, which is frankly true. And so thank you for having me in despite that.
Well, you know what? It's funny, Rick, because I was talking to Michael about you, having you on the show, and it occurred to me that what you do is very similar, for the below-the-line people, is very similar to what we do in terms of finding a niche of what is almost like an unserved audience in Los Angeles.
Exactly.
And sort of going out there and calling attention to them and helping them along. Were you, did you go to, for this last thing that you're doing here, for Glendale News and
Press.
Burbank Leader, Glendale Press, is that something you went to them with and say, look, I have something that would be valuable? Did they approach you? How did that work?
They actually did approach me. I would like to say that
you're very approachable.
As many hookers could tell you. They approached me. They told me, because I had a relationship with the editor at the who works. They're at LA Times subsidiary.
Right.
LA Times owned the Burbank Leader and the Glendale News Press, and they had said they had this idea for actually covering a part of the entertainment industry that is uncovered pretty much constantly. The producers and the writers and the directors and the stars, of course, get all the ink in the calendar section and elsewhere and on all the blogs. But the production designers, the costume designers, the casting directors,
the other 90%,
the people that actually keep the industry afloat, rarely get any kind of ink or what would be the cyber equivalent or screen time pixel time. They rarely get any of that. And would I like to write a column twice monthly about individuals in this area? Some of it possibly a little critical, depending, calling out some of the different studios for sending production, to Vancouver and Toronto, et cetera, and running away from L.A. This column would really be talking about how to keep production here. And I've only been doing it for about for a couple months, and so far so good. It seems to be resonating.
No, it does. And I read the most recent one, which this was fascinating to me because I was thinking about as great a show, and this is no negative against Breaking Bad at all. Fantastic show, obviously, and of course the response to the closing the ending episode and all that, just staggering numbers and all that. But what was most interesting to me about the article was that, I mean, the number of viewers that this FX show got, and then the other one you were talking about,
Criminal Minds,
Criminal
on CBS,
Minds,
yeah,
which is now which gets more viewers than that on a good on an average week, and but just that the vast number of people that show not only employs, but what it does for the Burbank and the Glendale economy. In terms of, I mean, each episode is $3.5 million.
Yeah, and it brings a few million into the community, you know, not just into the pockets of the people on the production. Yeah. You know, businesses in the area, restaurants, you know, stores, merchants, homeowners who rent out their houses to productions. You know, it really does keep money flowing into communities. Well, in Burbank and Glendale in particular, which is the interest of the column, but you know. And people don't realize how, you know, the little procedural that you'll see, the CSIs, the Criminal Minds, those kinds of shows, they you know, dwarf the numbers of eyeballs that go to, you know, Fox News and CNN and even shows like, you know, Breaking Bad, Man Med. On cable, it's minuscule. You know, it's really an elite audience, and that, of course, is often what, you know, you know, the more journalists go for, you know, because these are things that, you know, that they like and that are, you know, for a more elite crowd. But Joe Blow out there, you know, the people in America and Americana, that's what they watch. Wow. You know, they watch the Criminal Minds and those little those things wouldn't be on the air for 10, 12, 15 years.
That's my
Law
mother.
And Order, you know, the Law and Order, all the spinoffs of Law and Order, you know. Dick, we're not going to have any telethons for Dick Wolf.
I just set my mother up with Apple TV.
You did.
You know, I set her all up because she's got this.
That's where it comes with the, through the.
Yeah, they go your internet basically through the TV, okay. And you can get Netflix and all this stuff. And that was exactly it. That was her big concern. I'm still going to get Criminal Minds, right? Because I don't want it to.
You
change.
Can get Criminal Minds, I think, on you know, on tin cans and strings.
Sure. You can stand outside and wrap your head in tinfoil.
Pretty
and
much.
Get an episode of Criminal Minds.
It just comes straight into your cerebral cortex. Yes.
So now, as a television critic, you were a television critic for years. Do you still I'm going to say, do you still criticize television?
Well, yes, I do, but I don't do it professionally anymore. I'm simply an amateur armchair, you know, a critic. No, there are very few TV critics. It's dwindling. I did it for 25 years for various publications, Daily Variety, Hollywood Reporter, Orange County Register, LA Daily News, and the late lamented LA Herald Examiner. That's how old I am. You know, blogs and everybody with a blog suddenly was a critic of, you know, film, TV, stage. So that kind of competition, you know, these people, of course, do it for free. You know, there's far less call for, you know, the professional critic. TV critique was always kind of an odd sideline anyway, because, you know, movie critic, restaurant critics, even stage, you need to plan a night out. You need to plan the meal. You need to plan the night at the theater, the movie that you're going to.
Right.
TV is an impulse buy. TV is 2 seconds. Nah, I don't think so. Click.
Right.
So the role of TV critics is almost more, you know, kind of drawing you into a certain area. But you don't have to make more than a 2 second commitment to TV. So, you know, by its very nature, it's more transitory.
Right, right. It's not a planned evening.
Do you race a is your observance of television strictly the major networks, or do you and the major cable networks as well, or do you get involved in analyzing like TV Land?
All the networks. I mean, and that's the thing. You have to, you know, the lion's share still goes to the big networks and the so many cable networks though are doing scripted programming. You know, that anyone that does original programming, basically, you would get, you know, DVDs or screeners or links in advance before, you know, they would come on the air is how a critic operates. But, you know, the FX is AMC's, HBO, Showtime, you know, even Hallmark, you know, does, you know, 40 or 50 movies a year, and so you can't review everything. I mean, it's just so tonnage of programming.
I don't have much time at all, and when I do, it's very late at night after a full day of, you know, doing what we do, and I will flip around. But there's a couple of shows that I actually DVR, and one is on TV Land, and it's called The Execs. Have you seen this thing?
I've heard of it. I have not
it
seen it.
It is brilliantly written and brilliantly acted by
The Execs?
The Execs.
Yeah.
The Exits. I'm sorry. Not
the Exits.
Yeah, The Exits.
Oh, yeah. Oh, no, I've heard of that. Yeah. And see, the thing is, a lot of the smaller ones, including, you know, there's somebody I respect who used to write for MASH and Frasier and Mary Tyler Moore Show, a guy named Ken Levine. And he said a summer of watching TV, his favorite show was The Middle, which of course Jen Ray is on, who is a Sequest person.
One of our
person.
Company members, yeah.
Right? He said it was the funniest show, and it's déclassé to say it. You know, no critic worth his salt would ever say anything good about these shows that are considered déclassé. That's part of the problem with critique in general, is I find critics generally write to impress other critics. For the
nicely
most part.
Nicely said, sir. Yeah.
Rather than to actually inform the audience or give true information.
Or just verbally present themselves loving the sound of their own voice. That's a lot of the times. A lot of critics.
Showing the million-dollar word rather than the 10-cent word.
How clever they can be rather than actually... Mm-hmm. Well, they're called critics. They're not called encouragers.
I know. I knew that during my time as a TV critic, that was pretty much my sole concern was, how important can I make myself appear?
How did you get the? How did you? Did you go to the Simpsons people with the idea? Were you just hired?
Oh, for the book?
Yeah.
No, they.
I'm talking about The Simpsons: A Complete Guide to Our Favorite Family. This is HarperCollins, 1997, New York.
Yeah, I know the first 8 seasons of the show, and now, of course, it's ancient history. The show is now going into its 26th season next year. 26, they've just got approved for. You know, they're going to have 600 episodes pretty soon. No, they approached me because they knew they wanted to do kind of an official handbook covering the first 8 seasons, which they thought would probably end up being most of the run of the show. Now, of course, it's less than a third of the run of the show because the show will go on forever because it still makes incredible amounts of money in syndication.
And what's your name that does the voice of Bart Simpson?
Oh,
Yardley Smith?
No, Yardley Smith does Lisa. Oh. Bart Simpson is...
Nancy Cartwright. Right.
Very nicely.
I was actually
into my nightclub.
Oh, did you?
Yeah.
But you know, these people, they started off making $4,000 an episode as the voices, and now they each make $350,000 an episode.
I was working at the Falcon and the Falcon Theater, and Yardley Smith has done a lot of work there, and I remember. This was like a year ago, and I remember looking up, and I was like, "Oh yeah, I remember that actress. She did The Legend of Billie Jean. I remember that. God, it's a shame. Whatever happened to her career?" And I was thinking to myself, I was like, "God, I don't want to be that actor that now just works at a small, respectable theater in L.A. and nobody knows who she is." And then all of a sudden, it just hit me, and I was like, "Oh, pardon me, she's a zillionaire. Yeah. I totally forgot." Me.
It's the greatest job in the world for these people. You know, they can go in, and they're practically in their underwear day and a half and make. You know, $350,000 an episode.
Well, it's kind of like Paula Nye.
Yeah, exactly.
They come in here.
Precise.
Well, you know, she's also Nancy Cartwright is also very involved. I remember when they opened the theater at Cal State Northridge, Valley Performing Arts Center.
Yes.
Apparently, she went to Cal State Northridge, and she supports all their efforts there.
She throws some change their way.
I would imagine so. Lord knows she has enough of it. You know,
$144 million theater.
Yeah, it's a beautiful space.
Gorgeous.
I love that space.
Unbelievable.
And I know Dan Castellaneta. You know, still he could do whatever he wants since he's got that. He's got that income. He was in a wonderful play that I recall seeing. Did you ever see The Bicycle Men? It was this wonderful comedy.
No.
Wait a minute. It was in Chicago for a while.
It was in Chicago and then London.
Doesn't it have like a French
It's got a French whole basically completely, you know, satirizing the French, yes.
Yes, yes. And
Which was easy to do.
It played when I was doing a Straight Up with a Twist at the Broadway Theater in Chicago, and it played right around the same time. But Joe Liss.
Is exactly one of my favorite plays ever. Anyway.
Joe Liss and I did a old style beer commercial in Chicago, a Halloween themed old style beer commercial. I remember that's how I met Joe.
Wow,
so funny.
Great guy.
Just,
I love your wife, by the way.
Thank you.
Oh, yeah. The lovely and talented Jill Holden. Yes.
She's still teaching.
Any casting directors out there, I'm supposed to put in a word.
Oh, yeah?
Okay. She's available for TV show guest roles.
Jill Holden.
Film guest roles.
Jill Holden. Quite possibly one of the most naturally funny women.
Very funny.
She's a wonderful human being.
Played,
if I could be half the person she is, I would be accomplishing something.
She's wonderful. And she was actually on one of our earlier shows.
She was.
She was here talking about... arts education arts in
schools.
She
was on the show with Carol Channing.
With Carol Channing. Our third episode she was on.
Wow.
Our very third one, yeah.
I wish I could be on the show with Carol Channing.
Carol Channing on the show and a lovely woman.
Second episode.
Second episode.
Yeah.
But
you've been going for what, 3 years, 4 years?
Since this is our third year. Yeah. It's our third
Congratulations.
Year. But the Carol Channing episode, for our listeners, you want to go back and hear Michael and I getting our sea legs, go back and listen to that one. Because it was a little dodgy. We did fine, but... She spoke to us on a speakerphone.
Yes.
And I don't think that her hearing is what it was. It is an audio train.
Her voice is a speakerphone.
Yeah. Well, she was on the show for 5 minutes, and then she's like, "So when are we going to be on the radio?" Been on for 5 minutes, Miss Channing. Oh, hello.
I think you should just do an entire show where you're imitating her.
I think we should. Yes.
Yeah. So she's very lovely.
She is.
And we didn't know her husband was also going to be on our show.
Oh,
this happened to
a nice little surprise.
He was on as well.
And then she hit the phone in her house and disconnected herself.
Oh, yes, yes. She said,
how does this thing, what does this button do, quick?
No, the phone went dead, and she was in the middle of an Edna St. Vincent Millay poem, and the phone went dead, and then she called back. She goes, "I'm so sorry. I was gesticulating, and I hung up the phone." Like, oh. So, Ray, for the viewers of the web and the listeners of the radio show, give the websites that people can find your column. It's Burbank Leader.
It's burbankleader.com, B-U-R-B-A-N-K, leader, conventionalspelling.com, or Glendale News Press, which is much bulkier to write, glendalenewspress.com. Okay. And I haven't actually ever even seen the printed version. I understand it exists.
I have.
Is it just your name? Does the column have a title people can be able
to... It's actually called Towing the Line.
Towing the Line. Okay.
Towing the Line.
All right.
So I have to write the column barefoot, and I do.
Towing the Line because the focus is below the line crew people.
Precisely. You may have to be a below the line crew person to even understand the term. But
well, no, you know what? I was just going to ask you, and can you, 25 words or less, can you define how that term is arrived at, below the line?
You know, I think, is it not below the line with regard to screen credits?
Below the line producer, I think.
Right.
I think that might be all the way down to the line. But I don't know. That's a good question. Do you know?
No.
Well,
do not.
Because here I worked at Breakdown for 13 years putting out a publication mm-hmm. for below-the-line crew mm-hmm. jobs and never really understand the origin of the term. Yeah.
Well,
You worked for a publication?
A newsletter for below-the-line crew jobs.
Was it called Below the Line?
No.
Because there was actually one called Below the Line as well.
But I do a column called Below the Line. Did you know that?
I didn't.
Yeah, it's very successful.
Wow.
Yeah, for years.
Okay.
Wow.
All right. We got 2.5 minutes, and I want to start off by, we always like to ask our performer guests to share a mishap, some accident that happened on stage, something that's hopefully embarrassing, where there were no injuries, hopefully. Do you have one to share with us?
I'm going to knock on some serious wood here. I've been pretty blessed to have not ever have gone up really on stage to the point where the audience would know, but we had when I was doing Phantom in Vegas, it was a $90 million production and the most expensive theater venture in history, so there was a lot of technical aspects to the show, and
wow,
we had to stop the show a lot in the first couple weeks because the chandelier would get stuck, or you know, this $1 billion chandelier. but there's one scene. If you know Phantom, when Act 2 starts, it starts with the big staircase.
Mm-hmm.
And and then after the staircase, it then goes into the very next scene is in the manager's office, which is a very small, intimate space. And we did a show once where the staircase got stuck and did not leave the stage. And we did the entire manager's intimate office manager scene with a huge sprawling staircase in the middle of the stage.
That's a hell of an office.
Yeah, yeah. And what was great, we used the stairs. Like we kind of changed our blocking a little bit to step up on the stairs, and we were just like, well, it's here, let's use it. you know, trying not to laugh. I mean, it's hard to break. It's pretty hard to break me on stage, laughing wise, and I could not keep it together. It was pretty. It was pretty.
Did the audience pick up on it?
Oh, it was. Yeah.
It's a very luxurious office.
Yes. I mean, the audience was laughing with us, and you know, I mean, and it's one of those things that when that starts to happen, it gets a little scary because it's kind of you start to laugh uncontrollably.
Oh, and yeah. Because it's church laughter.
Right. Exactly right. Exactly. And that's the only time that's really ever happened to me, but it was pretty fun experience.
Well, listen, guys, what a pleasure to have both of you on our show.
Seriously.
We have to wrap it up here, Paul.
We do. But
Ray, how interesting. Good luck to you, sir.
Thank you so much, Michael and Paul. Thank you for having me on.
Ray's article, Towing the Line, as a Burbank leader in the Glendale News Press.
Yep.
Be on the lookout for that. And the show that Tim is doing is called, it's a world premiere musical, When You Wish. That's, of course, the life of Walt Disney. And that's at the Freud Playhouse. And it
Frood.
Can't help it.
Lots of sex and aggression at that theater.
Ticketmaster.com or call 310-825-2101. That's 310-825-2101. It opened last night, and it's only about...
through November 3rd.
Yes.
Yeah. And so a beautiful, beautiful, beautiful theater. And bring your whole family to this one.
Gentlemen, a pleasure. Always a pleasure.
Thank you very much.
Thanks for having me.
Great week. Paul, thank you. See you on the radio.
You're listening to State of the Arts with Michael Sterling and Paul Strolley right here on LA Talk Radio.